You are listening to Truth To You with Jono on the Meander Radio Network. Remember, all programs are archived and available to download at truthtoyou.org. That's truth number two, letteryou.org. G'day to everybody listening around the world. G'day to everybody listening in Jerusalem. Thank you for your company. Joining me this hour is a native Hebrew speaker who was born in the Galilee, Israel. He was raised in an Orthodox family. His father is an Orthodox rabbi, and he himself studied in yeshiva for 8 years. He's not a Christian. He's not a messianic. He is a Torah observant Jew. He also happens to be a graduate of the Chef Culinary School in Jerusalem and has been in the food industry for 3.5 years. He teaches Biblical Hebrew, my friends. He's a teacher of Biblical Hebrew and Modern Hebrew one-on-one via the internet. And it so happens that I am blessed to be one of his newly acquired students. By the way, he does have some time available to take on more students, so be quick if you've been considering Hebrew lessons, because quality one-on-one Hebrew tuition like this is not easy to find. The email address for Hebrew classes is hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. That's hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. Welcome to Truth To You, Yoel Ben Shlomo.
Hi, how are you doing?
My friend, I am doing very, very well. And of course, now, that's not all that you do. I know I've given you a bit of an introduction, but of course, your other interests include things like martial arts, and you also play a particular indigenous Australian instrument. What can you tell us about that?
Well, what I've been playing the past couple of years is actually a didgeridoo, hey! Which is very Australian.
Very Australian. How did you come about acquiring and taking up an instrument like that?
Well, it's very simple. First of all, I'm also very into ethnic music. Uh-huh. And when I was a child years ago, we're talking many years ago, I watched a program on television with my father about the Australia area, including New Zealand and other islands in the area. Mm-hmm. And part of the show was this man who went on the stage with a didgeridoo, and I was fascinated with it. And I remember what the person looked like. And it was put aside for many years, and one day when I was in yeshiva, we had this friend of mine, mm-hmm. who was one of these new age ethnic type of people, and he was staying in the dorms for a while because he had nowhere to go at that time.
Okay.
And I walked into his room one day just to say hello, see how he's doing, and there's this big massive piece of wood with open from both sides. It was obviously a part where you put your mouth and part the sound comes out from. Mm-hmm. And it looked very familiar, and I more or less remember what it is. I couldn't remember the name, but I knew more or less what it was, and I tried to play and sound came out, which is very unusual. Actually, one of my didgeridoo teachers told me it's very, very unusual for someone to actually produce such a good sound the first time. And so I played for a while.
Lo and behold, when you blew for the first time, you had you were able to bring out a note.
I was able to bring out a note, a very simple note, the basic what's called the drone, mm-hmm. Which is the basic sound which you build all the other sounds on top. And I put it aside, and then I was came back after a couple of days again looking for my friend. He was there. And I mentioned the fact that, I'm sorry I did this, I apologize, but I fill around with this piece of wood you have here. And he said, oh, my didgeridoo. And I said, okay, that's what it's called. Okay, now I have a name. And he said, well, were you able to produce a sound? I said, yeah. And he shook his head. That's unusual. Okay. And he let me try to do it. And he said, okay, you got a note. This is the drone. And it's not a perfect sound because it starts off as a bit slightly muffled. You have this rumble, but it's not 100%. Mm-hmm. And he showed me what a rhythm is. How do you build a rhythm? How do you build the your line that you're going to play?
Okay.
And he explained this to me, and okay, so then I went to the army, I forgot about it, and one day my wife decided to buy me a present, a didgeridoo. So that was actually the first didgeridoo I owned. And that same year, I actually found my first teacher, and he also builds didgeridoos here in Israel. Of course, it's not the traditional didgeridoos. We don't have the termites here in Israel, thank God, because they can cause a lot of damage. There was
you've got the eucalyptus trees, you've got the gum trees, but you don't have the termites. You also don't have the koalas, right?
We don't have the koalas. We don't. But also the eucalyptus tree we have here is a very, very specific type of eucalyptus. It's a reddish, yellowish wood. Mm-hmm. In Australia, there's a lot a larger variety of woods is, for example, the bloodwood, which is really red. So most of the didgeridoos you see here in Israel are either imported from Australia or made from the agave tree, which is this huge cactus type of tree which grows in Israel all over the place.
Really?
And so you see, you can make a didgeridoo out of anything. It's a hollow pipe, except for metal, because it has to vibrate.
It has to vibrate. Yeah.
But it has to vibrate. But that's what happens the first time you play. Your head starts moving, vibrating with the didgeridoo, and you're a bit shook up after the first time you play. And that's what happened. I got up and something's wrong here. My head's moving because it vibrates. Really, what you're hearing is the vibration going through the wood and coming up on the other end as a sound. Yeah.
Sure. And I mean, now let me ask you something, and it's kind of funny that I should be asking you this, but like a shofar, right? I have a Yemenite shofar, and I know it's possible to get maybe three notes out of a shofar. Can you get varying notes out of a didgeridoo?
Not exactly notes, but it's the exact same thing. In the didgeridoo, what you have is every didgeridoo has a note it's in. Mm-hmm. It varies on the thickness of the wood, how long the didgeridoo is, and there's a lot of websites, specifically in Australia, where people sell didgeridoos, and they give a very clear explanation of the length and how thick it is. And for example, I got this big, massive thing here, for example, and it's actually a very, very high note. And when I show it to people, people think, oh, it's going to be heavy and very low, and when I play it, it's extremely high, one of the highest notes that exist.
Wow.
So it's in what we call here in Israel fa, which would be in it's marked as an F in the note scale, and above that is another fa which is a bit higher than that.
So how many didgeridoos do you have?
Currently, I have three. I used to have more of them.
Wow!
I got three. One which is my favorite, which is the eucalyptus one I bought, and two other ones made from agave because it's not cheap. I mean, these things are not cheap. So the eucalyptus one is the expensive one, and I call it my baby.
Uh-huh.
it's basically it's my favorite. It's literally it's an amazing instrument. One interesting thing about this instrument is that there's a very famous lady from Holland who's a didgeridoo player, and she actually played this one.
Oh, sure.
So I also brag all the didgeridoo players around Israel when they see the didgeridoo. I tell them, oh, by the way, this lady played this, and everyone go, wow. So it's
and it's a mesmerizing instrument, isn't it? Because it's but unfortunately, now you've got a little bit of a cold. You've got you have to be able to perfect the circular breathing to be able to play the didgeridoo. And you got a little bit of a cold, so I don't know if we're going to be able to get you to do that today. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not too sure I'll be able to. I tried before the show to see what's going on with my circular breathing, and my nose is just slightly blocked, so I can't do it. You have to get a lot of air in.
Yeah.
Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to circulate the air in. Now, you can't breathe in and out at the same time. There's a trick to it.
Mm.
And this is one of the major things in playing the didgeridoo. You have to be able to breathe while you blow out the air. So it's not going to be possible today.
Not going to be possible today, lest you pass out and that'd be the end of the interview. So we better save that for as a treat for the next time that you come on to Truth to You. But let me just can I get you to explain to those who don't know? I mentioned earlier on, as I introduced you, that you studied in yeshiva for 8 years. What is a yeshiva?
Well, a yeshiva is, first of all, the word yeshiva, it's pronounced in Hebrew yeshiva, which means to sit. There's actually a bit of history to this word, because it used to be, the understanding in Orthodox Judaism is that when we study Torah and we pass on the Torah to someone else, it is as if we're sent on Mount Sinai. So for many, many years, at least this is what the stories that we have say, is that people taught and studied Torah while standing up. And at a certain point, the yeshivot became very big, and a lot of people had to be. Then sometimes the class, I mean, we're talking about, it was like university, were lectures, because the rabbi, the head of the yeshiva, had to pass on the information he received to the students. And it was only until there's a bit of a discussion about this amongst the researchers, but there is an opinion that says that everything was oral until around the 5th century. So what does that mean? We have the Mishnah. Very, very quickly, I'm going to put this. There's the Mishnah, which is the summary of the oral law into 6 volumes. Mm-hmm. And that was composed by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, or Rabbi Judah the prince. Uh-huh. And he composes. Doesn't mean he actually wrote it down. It was probably written down later on. And then we have the Talmud, which was composed around the 5th century. Mm-hmm. But there's an opinion that says it was only written around something like the 9th or 10th century. So basically what they were doing is when they stood at Mount Sinai and they were standing, then we have to stand as well. But it became impossible, so people started sitting down. So that's the word yeshiva. It's from
8 years of study.
I went 8 years of study now. There are different types of yeshivot. There are children that start technically yeshiva, which we really call Talmud Torah, or a religious school. Mm-hmm. From a very, very young age, their children, I know, from the age of 5, start studying the Torah like I did. Mm-hmm. At the age of 5, the first thing I learned was Bereshit Bara Elohim. That was the first thing I learned.
Okay.
And there's this whole thing where they put honey on your tongue and they make the Torah sweet on your tongue. A lot of interesting traditions.
Right.
And you start off basically learning Hebrew, learning the alphabet, learning all the vowels from a very young age. There are children by the age of 6 read Hebrew perfectly, a bit slow, but perfectly. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that you go through this process. They teach you the Torah. So you get the basis of the Torah itself, the word of the Torah itself, mm-hmm. and then they start introducing you to the Mishnah.
Right.
And then at a certain stage, they start introducing you to the Talmud, right. and they teach you how to read the Mishnah, what does the Mishnah say, and they teach you how the Talmud works. There is a set of rules how to decide what the Talmud is actually saying. And the Talmud is mostly written in Aramaic. This is why most Orthodox Jews have a basic understanding of Aramaic. Mm-hmm. Some people actually sit down and study Aramaic literally to understand the Babylonian Aramaic. And people also study the Jerusalem Talmud because there are 2 Talmuds. There's one which is the Babylonian one, uh-huh. and one which is the Jerusalem one was really composed in Tiberia, in Tiberias, because at that time the Jews were really in the Galilee, prohibited from coming to Jerusalem.
Oh, okay.
But they call it Jerusalem Talmud because of the will to return to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And you can go into yeshiva for your entire life as well. You know, it's not like going to high school. You go to school and you go from stage to stage, and you go to university and you're done with that and you have your degree. Now, a lot of people, and I know a lot of people do this in the ultra orthodox world. It's almost everyone. They stay in yeshiva for their entire life.
Truly.
And they're studying Torah from the age of 5 to the age of 100. And that's all they do in their entire life. And these are the people who become the great sages of the Orthodox world.
Right.
And this, for example, one of the major rabbis in Jerusalem, Rav Eliashiv, is in his late 90s, and he has been studying from the age of 5.
Goodness.
And he doesn't do anything but study. And people go to him to ask him questions, sometimes really complex questions, and you always see pictures in there. Almost no, a lot of pictures of him walking around the street. But most of the pictures that people have of him is him standing over, sitting over a book, and right. that's all he does.
Wow! From the age of 5 to the age of 90, and then beyond. And so,
exactly.
So in yeshiva, obviously, this is where you studied ancient biblical Hebrew, right? I mean, this is where you were. You were born in Israel, but you studied biblical Hebrew. This is where you studied. Is that correct?
Well, not exactly. I studied Biblical Hebrew from the age of 5. Okay. Biblical Hebrew is different from regular Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
There are grammatical changes. There are different usages of words. Sometimes you look at the Bible and you see a word, and in modern Hebrew we mean one thing, and in Biblical Hebrew we mean a completely different thing. And I've had this happen to me so many times. So from a very young age, I actually started trying to understand what the words are saying. So in most Orthodox houses, what we have are these special volumes with commentators on the Torah, the Navi, mm-hmm. basically the entire Bible. And amongst the commentators, we also have what we call the medakdikim, the people who sat down to analyze the textual part of the text and not what it's actually saying. So they broke things down into words and phrases, and what does this phrase mean? and what does this word mean? What is the root of the word? And I've been doing this for many years. Mm-hmm. And also, I went to a special yeshiva where it's basically a combination of a yeshiva together with a high school. Now, this exists in the States, but here in Israel, you have a clear division. You have there are a lot of these types of schools, but you have a regular school, a secular school, and you have an ultra-Orthodox school. And in between, what happened was that the regular Orthodox decided to create this combination where you have half the day is yeshiva, half the day is regular high school.
Okay.
So inside the school, what we learned was biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew, and we also connected them because my Hebrew teacher was a religious person, mm-hmm. so he always was able to connect this to the Tanakh. So a lot of us got a really, really good education on these things, but I kept on. I didn't finish high school and say, that's it. I carried on into yeshiva, and basically one of the main books on my study desk was the Tanakh. Uh-huh. And it was one of the main things I always studied. Mm. And I've had a lot of discussions with people over these things. So my knowledge in Tanakh is a bit wider than the average person here in Israel.
And that's one of the reasons why you're on this program, my friend. And now, being that you are both a Hebrew teacher and a qualified chef, and being that, because, you know, this is the time of year that we are in, I thought it might be fun to ask you about words like matzah, words like leaven, you know, being that we are approaching Pesach, do you reckon we could discuss some of those words?
Yes, of course. That's one of the reasons I'm here. Okay, so we will begin. I won't go to what matzah is yet, but mm-hmm. everyone knows what a matzah looks like. I mean, you can also Google the word, you see matzah, and you see this flat cracker thing.
Actually, you know what? Yeah, well, I got onto the internet and I had a look at I looked up matzah, and not only can you see the flat square cracker and how it looks, but you can also get all of these accessories like baby bibs. I even saw a matzah pattern toilet cover that said on the front of it, "Let my people go."
That's terrible.
I know. Oh, come on, it was funny. There was even Matzah Man. You could turn him on. He does a little dance and sings a matzah song.
Oh, that's so funny. That's what people do. They commercialize religion. That's a bit of an issue.
Yeah, I know. That's the matzah. But leaven. Now, we're in, obviously, leaven. We're talking about Exodus chapter 12, right?
Yes. For the first place, we have this concept of leavened is in Exodus 12. And I'm going to, first of all, let me open up my Tanakh so I actually have the words in front of me so I can create the connotation. Mm-hmm. So what does it say? It says from verse 15, uh-huh. it says that for 7 days you will eat matzahs. About, the word ach is not exactly but. It's like you shall on the first day tashbitu. This is a bit difficult to translate directly from the Hebrew, mm-hmm. but tashbitu is to stop or to cancel, and basically saying to get rid of all the si'or from your houses. That's the first word we're going to deal with. Mm-hmm. And anyone who will eat chametz, that's the second word, leavened, will be cut off from the people of Israel from the first day to the seventh day. Okay?
Okay.
I deliberately do not use English translations. The translations are extremely misleading, so I prefer to look at the Hebrew words and try to translate the best I can at the moment, because sometimes what you see is something is a new angle you look at. So it's always good to go back to the Hebrew and, oh, there's a new angle here. Let's look at this.
Well, that's the first, the first thing I notice, Yoel, because I'm reading in English. It says 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and you said matzah. On the first day you shall remove Seol, is that right? Is that correct?
Seol. No, I was saying the Hebrew. I was saying the Hebrew word and not translating to English, because I also wanted people to recognize the words themselves as well.
Right, because here it's got the same word for each of these three different words. Because the next one, remove Seol, which I've got leaven from your house for whoever eats unleavened bread, and the word that you had there.
Actually, it says anyone who eats chametz, which is leavened bread.
Ah, leavened bread. Sorry, you're right. Chametz. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about three different words that's represented in a similar way here. So obviously there's something deeper.
Okay, so I want to start from what you're not supposed to do and then go to what you're supposed to do. That's the, I think, the best way. Mm-hmm. And so we'll start first of all from the word se'o. What is se'o? The word se'o on the dictionary level, means any leavening agent.
Okay, anything? Now am I to understand it's not just yeast, it's any leavening agent, anything that will...
Well, yes, it is, but we also have to be very clear about the fact that it doesn't mean that any leavening agent you have to get rid of. Okay, what it's saying is you have a leavening agent, take it out of your house. But historically wise, and this is going to be a bit of chemistry and history here, in the ancient world, they had one very specific leavening agent, and that was making dough. And this is what, if people make at home, they're going to recognize the word I'm about to describe. It's called sourdough.
Yes.
And what they did is they would make a dough, let it sit for a couple of days, and it will go sour. What will happen then is they will take a piece from the sourdough, and usually if you have to really start from the beginning, you make a small dough because you don't need more than that, because people baked almost every day or every couple of days because bread will stale. It's not like the magic bread that they have, for example, in the States, which is this strange thing that never goes off. It's very... My wife's brother went to the States and they bought this bread and they had it for 2 weeks and it was fine.
Oh, that scares me.
They all went, what is this thing? So they were very, very surprised. So what they had was what they call a sourdough. Now, there are two ways of producing sourdough.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a dough and let it, let it sour. What you're doing is you're creating a fungi in the dough itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this fungi, when you take it and put it inside your new dough, it eats the sugars inside the flour. And this is why you usually have to put a lot of diabetic people out there. They're afraid of bread with sugar. Mm-hmm. And here in Israel, for example, a lot of the bread is sweet. And it's almost disgusting. I most of the bread I make is at home,
mm-hmm.
and I also worked as a baker for a very, very long time. Amongst the things I did in the culinary world, I also took the position of a baker, so I know how this thing behaves.
Right.
And what happens is you put the sugar in, and this thing is technically called brewer's. This is what its name is, but it's not necessarily from the brewers, but it's the brewer's sugar fungi, and it eats sugar. So when you're actually eating the bread, you're not really eating any sugar because this fungi eats the bread, and that's how it multiplies.
Okay.
Now, the process is very simple. You have either this sourdough, or you create this culture. You cultivate this fungi in a jar, and what you do is you take water,
mm-hmm.
and you put flour and sugar in, and you keep on feeding this thing. Every day you feed it sugar and flour, and you keep it alive.
Okay.
And what you do is it's
like a pet.
It smells.
You give it a name.
You can give it a name. Okay. I know of several jars like these around the world, which have been around for over 100 years.
Oh, really?
People which have been feeding these things for over 100 years.
Oh, wow.
There's one in France, which is kept in a cooled safe. And it belongs to one of the biggest bakeries, or one of the most important bakeries in France.
Uh-huh.
And there's another one in the States from 1840, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's been fed as well in the exact same method.
So Yoel, not only can it be your pet and you can give it a name, but your children and their children's children can inherit it.
Exactly. You can pass this on. But that's the problem, because when Pesach comes over, Chag HaMatzot comes over, you have to get rid of it. And that's what it's saying. It says that you have to take all these leavening agents. These are the leavening agents the Torah is talking about, because there are other forms of leavening agents, which I'm going to get to in a moment.
Sure.
And it says you have to get rid of this. Okay?
Okay.
And don't listen to this. Someone I know who claims he found on the internet that some of the flour we have lacks the enzymes that cause this fungi to reproduce. I know this as a fact to not be true. I've spoken with people who make these things at home. Several families that the wives are amazing bakers. They make these amazing breads, things you will not find in any place, any store you go into, even specialty stores. You will not find these breads. These are special recipes that no one takes the time to make.
Mm-hmm.
And they use these sourdoughs or these sour colonies of this fungi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very important to understand. If you have something like this at home, you have to get rid of it. Now, the best way is to burn it. This is what's done in the Orthodox world. Most people burn it. I actually received an email not long ago from a family I know who are entering Torah in the past couple years, and the wife actually makes sourdough. And she asked, what do I do with this? I said, I'm sorry to say, but you have to get rid of it. Other leavening agents, and these are there's a bit of discussion about one section of these leavening agents, and there's another two leavening agents which are not a problem. Mm-hmm. There's the regular yeast people buy.
Yes.
There are three types of these yeast. There's the fresh yeast, which is, I would say, if I'm not mistaken, is scraped from the barrels of beer.
And,
This is why it's called, also called the brewer's fungi.
Yes.
And by the way, very, very, very interesting thing before we go there, and I just remembered, and this is probably going to blow a couple of people away. The earliest record we have of leavened bread in history mm-hmm. is from Egypt.
How about that? The earliest record of leavened bread that we have is from Egypt. It's my understanding too, by the way, and I could be wrong, but my understanding is that beer is a product of ancient Egypt as well.
The earliest beer I know of is actually from Babylon. And we call it, not from Babylon, it's from Madai, which is part of the Persian kingdom.
Is that right?
So it's called, in the Mishnah, it's called Shechar Hamadi.
Now, the sad news, I was just going to say, the sad news is, of course, that beer has yeast in it, right? And so, unfortunately, beer has to go as well. Is that correct?
Exactly. All beer has to go as well. This is also something which is fermented. Now, let's make it very, very clear. Not everything which is fermented is prohibited. Mm-hmm. It's anything which has been fermented, which is its source is from grain. So, for example, wine is fermented. Everyone knows this.
Yes,
but that doesn't mean that's what we call chametz. Surprisingly enough, I mean, here in Jerusalem, we actually have Karaites, a few of them. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking around once in the old city, and I bumped into this Karaite. And this was years ago when I was about 16, and I literally asked him, what is chametz in your world? And he said, well, pickles, for example, we call chamutzim in Hebrew because most of the pickles here in Israel are sour. We don't make the sweet pickles, for example, like you have in the States. Mm-hmm. He told me that's not, we don't call that chametz, but there are Karaites that will not drink wine during Pesach.
Ah.
And I shook my head. I was very surprised. But that's not what the verse says, because it's Se'or and Chametz in comparison to Matzot. So it has to do with bread. It has to do with grains. But anyhow, that's their tradition. I'm not going to argue with them too much about this.
No, fair enough. But can I ask you just a little bit about that without getting off the subject? But so my understanding is beer has to go, but the wine, because it is not from a grain, but it's from the grape, it is okay. That's fascinating because I was all because wine does have a yeast in it though, does it? Does it not?
It has another form of fungi, but this is not the yeast we're talking about. This is yeast that has to come from
the grain.
From grains.
Okay.
Because, for example, here's another here's another question I was asked. This was forwarded to me by a friend of mine, and there's this beverage which is made from fermented milk, and this fermented milk. There are these grains, these like crystals that accumulate in the bottom of the fermenting vessel, uh-huh. and you take these grains. And from what I understand, this really surprised me. I know of this beverage; it's called kefa.
Yes,
it comes from the yeast, from the east, not yeast, yes. East. And
probiotic.
What I understand, you throw it in into regular milk, and it uh-huh. eats up the glucose.
Right.
And there's this family, apparently, who also knew when entering into Torah. Mm-hmm. I think they're from the Hebrew Roots movement. I'm not too sure. Mm-hmm. And they drink a lot of milk. And they ask, can we use this during Pesach? And my answer was, of course you can. But do yourself a favor. Don't put this into flour. Don't make bread with this. Uh-huh. Because this is still a leavening agent. So you really when you go into a store, into a supermarket, what you really would find are three types of yeast, and there's another type which is used in industry, which you can't buy. It's a chemical, a very, very powerful chemical. Mm-hmm. It usually comes like a small sphere, and you throw it in, and this thing, this tiny little thing, can cause tons of dough to rise. But when you go into your store, you're going to find either what we call beer yeast, mm-hmm. which is what they scrape from the bottom of these barrels.
That's it.
And you also find the same. It's the same, almost the same thing, but it's with what we call wet yeast or non-dry yeast, which you usually in Israel they come in cubes, and these things are a bit soggy. You touch them, they fall apart. Mm-hmm. You also can buy the same thing as a powder, but it's still very, very soft. Has a lot of water in it. You also have dry yeast, which is again a very simple thing. You basically have these grains, mm-hmm. which are yeast agents, but yes. They're all these things are derived from the same substance. It's the same thing repeated in different ways. And also, there's also instant dry yeast, which was invented in the 70s, and these come like these little tiny, tiny oval-shaped things, mm-hmm. and these are types of yeast you have to wake up, which means you have to put them in lukewarm water with sugar, and that you make them ferment, and they create this like this layer on top of foam, and then only then you can use them. So these are three things you mostly find as regular yeast. The other agents, and these are chemicals, and every housewife knows these chemicals, is baking soda.
Yes.
And there's another variation of it, which is baking powder. Now, what's the difference between these two things? Very, very simple. Baking soda is a one-action leavening agent, which means it uses baking soda is an alkaline substance, mm-hmm. and it uses the acid in the flour itself to cause the fermentation, and you have the baking powder, mm-hmm. which are two substances combined together. One is the soda itself and another substance. One is alkaline, the other one is acidic, and they mix together, and then mm-hmm. they cause the fermentation. Now, what exactly is fermentation? I'm sorry I'm so technical, but
everything's
very, very clear.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Fermentation is basically the creation of carbon dioxide inside your dough, which causes it to rise.
Right.
That's all that happens. But what is the difference in between these two forms of leavening agents? One is literally what we call se'or. This is literally the substance we call se'or. And this is what the Torah is referring to. And the other substances are not se'or. So they're, we have this term gufa. The actual body of the substance itself is not what the Torah is referring to. But the action it does is a problem. So, for example, if you decide to make a cake or you decide to make bread and you say, oh, well, this is not so, I'm going to throw this into my bread or my cake, mm-hmm. don't. That will be chametz. That will be what we call chametz.
Ah,
okay.
Right.
And chametz is the term leavened bread, leavened anything.
I see, I see. And thus, here are the two categories, the two words that are used in Exodus chapter 12, verse 15. There's two categories here, and both of those are therefore prohibited for Pesach and the week of unleavened bread. Can I ask you a question about a favorite Australian product? That would, of course, be Vegemite. Vegemite. Everybody loves what everyone
Vegemite. And everyone we have our version. We have our own version here in Israel, which comes from England, which is Marmite, which is almost the exact same thing.
It almost is. Yeah, so
I grew up with Marmite at home.
It's beautiful on your toast on a winter morning.
Exactly. Oh, wow. Yeah, it's one of the best things in the world. Yeah,
that's
it's a winner.
Right.
By the way, Israelis don't really like it. It's very strange. I used to go to school with Marmite, and everyone would go, what is that? It's black. It's gooey. What is it? And I said, it's tasty. That's what it is.
Yeah, it is. It's a winner. Can we keep Vegemite or Marmite in the cupboard?
Okay, so that's a very, very good question. Our practice, and this is what my father taught me, was not to keep Marmite because it is produced from yeast.
Uh-huh. That's right.
If I remember correctly, I haven't eaten Marmite in years. It's extremely expensive here in Israel. we used to We used to bring it from England. When someone went to England, a friend, family, or someone in the family itself went to England, they would come back with jars of it. and the commercial size jars, we're talking about the small ones, the commercial ones, the big ones.
Yeah, right.
And they would last for a very, very short time because everyone liked putting on their toast first thing in the morning the Marmite.
Yeah.
So I would say you're not allowed to use Marmite or Vegemite.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen actually the ingredients of Vegemite. So that's I'll be very glad if you can send me the ingredients and then I can read them and tell you if yes or not. But if I remember correctly, these contain beer yeast.
Yes,
so that's
I think you are right. Yeah.
You can't put Vegemite in your matzo either.
Okay. All right.
There was another question. This is also a very interesting question. Just a second. It is the issue of pasta. I was sent an email by a friend, and I do not have a clear answer on this one. Pasta is very, very complex. Now, if anyone has ever made pasta at home, they know that the ingredients are flour, lots of eggs.
Mm.
That's why pasta is yellow.
Sure.
And you have like a few teaspoons or a few tablespoons of water. There's not much water in pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's irrelevant if it's water or eggs. We understand that any liquid, because even eggs contain water.
Mm.
For example, you make a fried egg. Why does it fry instantly? Because while frying it, you're trying to evaporate the water from it.
Sure. Okay.
And this is why, for example, here in Israel, we have a division between dairy places, dairy restaurants, and meat restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the places I worked at was this dairy restaurant, and we had breakfast. You know, dairy restaurants, if there's a breakfast or anything, we do it there. And what happened was that you have to really know how to properly fry an egg. And there was this new cook there who was, I think it was his first day on the job or something. And he was supposed to make a fried egg, and it was supposed to be an upside down egg. Because what I'm thinking is it's an egg where you still keep the yolk, and so it's called a sunny side up.
Yes.
But what they wanted was when you turn over.
Yeah, that's a lot
like him. He couldn't figure out why it was still jelly. He turned it over, but it stayed very. It was still, you know, the jelly was still there.
Sure.
It was still the white was still there. Why was it still clear? And I had to explain to him that what you're doing is you're evaporating the water from the egg itself, and you have to have the right temperature. It can't be cold because you're going to be standing there for hours waiting for it to heat up.
Sure.
And it can't be too hot because you're going to burn it. It's going to stay gooey inside and burnt from the outside.
Mm.
So it's irrelevant if you're using eggs or any other agent. It still has water and will cause it to ferment.
Isn't that interesting?
But the problem is there's this rule of thumb. Anything containing water, even oil contains a certain level, very, very small amount of water, but there's still water there.
Sure, sure.
Even if you put oil in your matzah, you're still going to have a problem with it fermenting. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you a story of one of the times when I went to I was supervising production of handmade matzahs, which are the round ones.
Oh.
And you're going to drop off your feet how it works.
I'm not going to let you forget because I remember you telling me about huge piles of olive wood. We're going to get back to that. Okay, I won't forget.
But that's the outside. What goes inside is even more insane. It's just amazing how people do this. And this is, by the way, this is why matzos are so expensive. We'll get to it. I'll explain it.
If anyone knows, because obviously the pasta is, so it's made of a flour and an egg, and some water, and once it comes into contact with these other ingredients, is there a risk of a leavening process? And you haven't been able to confirm either way. So if anyone knows anything further about this, most certainly leave your comments on Truth to You under this post. We'd be very interested to find out. But there's I suppose you might call that a gray area, yeah?
It's a gray area. I mean, in the Orthodox world, what we do is we just get rid of it.
Sure.
And you'll see people coming to the bonfire that we burn the chametz on with bags of pasta, and they're burning the pasta, and it's a shame. So one of the things we actually developed here in our area, we have a store owner who's not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And people spoke with him, and what he does is before Pesach, he literally buys the chametz from you.
Uh-huh.
This is not a fictitious sell. He buys it, and he sells it to other people.
Mm-hmm.
meaning it completely belongs to him and he does with it whatever he wants.
Right.
Okay, and this is way before Pesach. So, for example, yesterday we took anything we thought we might not be able to sell, mm-hmm. to eat, and we sold it to him. Mm. I am taking my chametz to a person who doesn't care about the Torah, and I say to him, take this, use it as you wish, this is yours, and he actually literally pays me the full price of this product.
Okay.
Okay? That's one thing. That's me way before Pesach. It's not me like the last second I'm trying to save something. This is me. A week, 2 weeks before. Here, take and he buys it. Does it for everyone. It also saves the issue of burning food. It's a real shame to get. If you have an open package, nothing you can do. But if you have closed packages and things like that, the best thing to do is because it's really a waste and it's a shame if there's another way of doing it. Because your purpose here is leva'er. You have to get rid of it from your area, from your house, from whatever belongs to you, from your immediate area, any space that belongs to you, you're not supposed to have chametz. If your non-Jew neighbor, and specifically here in Israel, you have a lot of these cases, and obviously if you're living outside of Israel, it's everyone around you, almost everyone around you is not Jewish. Mm-hmm. Doing that is a better way of doing it. You know, just get rid of it, and it doesn't belong to you anymore.
Sure.
And I think this is a legitimate way of practicing it, because you don't have to insist. The word leva'er is from ba'ar, which can mean to burn, but not necessarily means that. What it means is to get rid of it.
Okay. You know,
just get rid of it. And for example, we have in the Tanakh, in the prophets, it says that they did a bi'ul for the idolatry. It doesn't mean they actually burned it. What do you mean? They destroyed it. So they've got a way, found a way of getting rid of it.
Okay.
So specifically, pasta is a bit of an issue. It's not very clear because it doesn't have time to leaven.
Mm.
Because what you're doing is you're thinning it out and it dries out.
Mm.
It literally dries out. The only thing I have seen, and this is my reason to believe you should get rid of it, and this is why the practice here is to get rid of it, because when you make ravioli,
yes,
okay, when you make handmade ravioli, unless you're a Gordon Ramsay, who's this amazing Scottish chef, and everyone probably knows his shows. Obviously, you also seen in Australia. This guy makes ravioli really, really fast. But if you take your time and you're making it at home, the first time I actually made ravioli, when I was slow about it, I noticed that the dough did start puffing.
Uh-huh. Which obviously so is a sign of fermentation inside, right?
Exactly. That's what it means. I notice it puffs. If you're taking your time and you let it sit for a while, it does start fermenting. It's slow. It's extremely slow. It's not like, you know, when you put a leavening agent and it just starts puffing. Mm. Or if you put baking soda, that really works really, really fast.
Yes.
That's the difference. It's a very, very interesting thing. For all the housewives out there, if you're listening to this, there is a reason using baking soda for cakes and yeast for bread. The yeast works slowly, and what it does is the gluten inside the dough enables these bubbles to be created, and they're able to sustain the bubbles for a longer time. On the other hand, the softer doughs, which you use cakes with, is not strong enough. There's not enough gluten there, so you have to make it puff very, very quickly and stabilize very, very quickly.
Right. I didn't know that.
Okay. Okay, that's something new. It is. I mean, when you're baking cakes and bread, and this is one of the major things you do in your kitchen, it suddenly dawns on you. Wait, there's a reason this is done like this, and this isn't like this. And so I've learned a lot from just working as a baker as well.
Yeah.
We usually call a chef pâtissier, but I'm not really a pâtissier. I never actually studied the pastry part of cooking, but I have enough experience that I know what I'm doing. So I actually had an incident where someone actually stood there and argued with me how to make bread, and I said, okay, here's an option. And this guy went to one of the most prestigious schools in Israel called Tadmor, which is in Herzliya, one of the best and most expensive schools in Israel for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And as one of the main chefs I worked with said, it's really mostly experience. And that actually went in my head, and I remember this, and I remember arguing with this guy. This guy is brilliant. This young man I know, he is a brilliant chef, and he works really, really hard and really fast. Mm. And we made a competition. And he saw how my bread came out, and he was like, how did you do this? I said, it's experience. You get the feel how it works. You're sitting with a piece of paper giving you the ingredients, and all I have to do is think what I'm doing. What is wrong here? Because if you make a mistake, you're not always aware of what you're doing.
Mm.
And this is the issue of experience. So, okay. Now I'm bragging. I'm sorry. Now I'm bragging.
No, it's okay. Now, speaking of making bread, though, I really want to know. You were telling me about the handmade matzah, right?
Okay. So first of all, what is matzah? That's the last word we have here. Matzah.
Mm-hmm.
The word matzah, it means unleavened. Okay, and here's the best thing to do. I'm going to pull out my special dictionary, my biblical dictionary, and I'm going to look up the word matzah. I want a definition for the word to make sure that we actually, because when I say matzah in my head, immediately I know what it means because it's a word in Hebrew. Sure. But we're going to pull out the dictionary. There's the word matzah. Okay, same thing. Unleavened, a dough which is unleavened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we don't have too much to think here. So what does that mean? What it means is there's no carbon dioxide in between the gluten chains inside the dough.
Beautiful.
That's what it means technically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're not really, when you make leavened dough, you're not really changing inside anything inside the chemistry of the dough.
Mm-hmm.
What you are doing is first of all, you have to work the dough. This is a very, very important thing. And this also makes, sorry about that, this is what makes dough, this is, for example, when you make matzahs, when you taste them, you can taste that something's different in each matzah. And when you taste bread, you can feel that something is different.
Sure.
And what happens is you have to work the dough, and you're basically working the gluten chains. And by doing that, you're making it more flexible, more elastic. But what also means it will rise better.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So remember, when you make dough at home, make sure you work it well. You let it rise once, you take out the carbon dioxide, you take out the air, you work it again. You're making it better, and then you have a second rise. And that's the best way to make bread. Okay. Not having one rising, having two risings, and then the dough comes out the best. That is the best way of making bread. I'm saying this from experience. I've baked tons of baked goods, so I'm talking tons of literally in weight.
Right.
So this is the best way. This is, if there's anything anyone will actually get from this, is the best way to make dough. okay, so what is matzah? So we said matzah is unleavened, mm-hmm. and I'm going to give you a description, an inside description, of what a matzah bakery looks like.
Please.
So as you mentioned before. I told you about this thing where you would go into these special bakeries. These are special bakeries only for these. No one goes in there during the year. They're open for like 4 months a year, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 5 months. They start baking from very early. Matzahs last very, very, very long.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, by the way, a very important thing. There's another name for the word matzah, which is lechem oni. If you bump into that, poor man's bread. What that means, there are different opinions of what it means. It's unleavened bread.
Okay.
Some people say not only unleavened bread, it also means bread which is made from low quality flour, like barley flour.
Uh-huh.
Different opinions. But the Talmud says what it means is that the poor man is so hungry, he doesn't wait, and he makes this bread very, very quickly.
Uh-huh.
He just makes it up, puts it on the fire, cooks it very quickly, and eats it.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And so... That's usually what we explain what matzah, lechem oni, actually means. So what happens in these bakeries? It's just the most amazing thing. These places work very, very, very fast. They have a time limit. And you have to have the matzah from the moment you pour the water into the flour until it comes out from the oven, not more than 18 minutes. Not more than 18 minutes. 18 minutes, and most places do it in 13 minutes. And you have these men, I mean, you should see these guys' arms, because when you work with this dough, it's relatively hard dough,
uh-huh.
you really develop muscles.
Yeah, right.
And I've seen these guys' arms. Some of these guys have really massive arms. And what goes in is very simple. First, you go in, there's this court, and there's olive wood. And the olive wood is used for this oven, this literally a furnace,
uh-huh.
Which is a natural, it's a brick oven, and they only use wood in it, and they use olive wood. And my guess is, if I remember correctly, is that the olive wood has less water in it than most types of wood. And this wood, by the way, is cut and sit and put aside to dry for a very, very long time.
Right.
So when they throw it in, there's no chance of any vapors inside the oven, and there's no chance of it hitting any water and keep carry on the fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
And it works like this. And this is the amazing thing. happening. First of all, there's one room with flour, and there's another room with water. And these two places are completely separate.
Uh-huh.
And even beyond that, the flour itself is special flour harvested from the year before, kept in special places so they won't come in contact with any water.
Wow.
Okay, this is why matzos are so expensive. It's a process from the beginning. The moment the wheat is ripe, they run out, they cut it to make sure no last rains hit this wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And then they immediately take it out of the field and take out the seeds and everything, and they're kept in special places. And towards the time when they open up these bakeries, they actually, some people hand mill these, but they take them and they turn them into flour.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kept in a special room. And there's this guy who comes with this bucket, and he goes to the guy with the flour, and he puts the flour in, and then he goes to the other guy in the other room, and there's like this small opening in between the rooms.
Really?
Like this tiny little window, and they have an exact weight they're allowed to put every time. There's this rule. You put an exact weight every time of flour, not more than that.
Uh-huh.
Never more than that. There's a rule in the Talmud. I think it says Shlosh Trevekav, which would be, I think, it's less than a kilo of flour every time.
Sure.
But from each kilo of this flour, they make like, I would say, maybe 10 matzahs.
Okay.
What's in this? So he goes to the man with the water, he puts the water in, he goes to the special room. It's all in different rooms. There's a special room, and they start mixing the flour with the water very, very quickly. Everything is done very, very fast. There's a timer on the wall, and if the timer beeps, they throw it away.
Oh, really?
And I've seen it done. I have seen it done. And it doesn't matter in whatever stage. If it beeps, that's it.
That's it. You're done.
Wow. Throw it out.
That's amazing.
It's crazy. It's literally crazy. People yelling and screaming. It feels like a kitchen. I mean, if you've ever been in a professional kitchen, it's like run and people running around and throwing things around. It's crazy. It's insane. It's literally insane. And so there's these special tables with these, and this dough is very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a special table with these, what they call in English, these pins, which you rolling pins, but these big, massive rolling pins connect the table, and this guy is jumping, bouncing on this rolling pin with his hands, hitting the dough to try to make it into a dough, and he's banging this thing, and he does it for like a minute or two, and then immediately there's a guy who takes away from him, runs to the next room, and then you have the guys with rolling pins. So you have one guy who stands at the end of the table, and he makes a sausage out of this rolling pin, and he has the special knife, which is clean. All the tools are cleaned the moment they're done working with them. So the guy with the rolling pin.
Each time.
So nothing sticks. There's nothing small there that sticks. Literally, and every time they make a session, they have to wash the tools. Now, they're two different things. There's the ones, the people who come, and they're very, very strict about things. Strict, and they... Literally every 18 minutes, they have to wash the tools. Every 18 minutes. So we're talking about a process of making, say, 6 kilos of matzahs can take a couple of hours.
Oh, my goodness.
And unusual working rate, they have 18 minutes, and they can make several kilos of matzah in those 18 minutes.
Wow.
Okay?
It sounds like an endurance sport. I mean, it sounds like some sort of endurance sport or some sort of marathon, right?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's literally you're running against the clock.
Yeah.
Literally racing against the clock. And this guy stands there. And by the way, the rule is as long as you're playing with the dough, this is the rule in the Talmud.
Uh-huh.
And as long as you're playing with the dough, it will not ferment. And this is actually something well known. As long as you're playing with the dough and even if you put it inside your mix or something, it will not ferment. It will not start leavening. And so this guy has a sausage, and he cuts his tiny little pieces, and he gives it to the guy who's called the opener, where he has a rolling pin. By the way, everything's made from nerosta. What's nerosta in English? It's a special metal you go into all the kitchens, all the professional kitchens.
Stainless
steel metal. We call it nerosta in Israel. So it's very easy to clean as well.
Mm.
And this guy who's called the opener, he opens it up, and they pass it on to another guy, and there's the finisher in the end, which makes this super, super thin. Thin dough opened up really big, and he gives it to the baker. Now, the baker is the thing. The baker gets the most of the money on this deal because he has to know when to take the thing out. It's so thin, and it's so fast, the baking. And we're talking about baking is like seconds.
Uh-huh.
He throws it in, waits a second, pulls it out. And the issue is that they're trying to keep everything really, 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 really fast. Yeah. And by the time it reaches the end, they have this piece of cracker, which, by the way, doesn't taste bad at all. It's actually, the handmade ones are really, really tasty.
Sure.
But that's the process of producing handmade matzahs. Now, in fact, when they make machine matzahs, it's simpler, it's machine, no one's running, no one's doing anything. Yeah. But there is a time limit. They're also working on time limits.
Sure.
They're also working on 18 minutes, but it's machine made, so it's a lot faster.
That's incredible. So what is the attraction of having a handmade matzah over just machine factory matzah? Is it the novelty or is it the taste?
It's really the novelty. It's really the issue of the handmade matzah. There's this concept in Judaism that if you do something for the sake of the commandment, it's better quality spiritually wise.
Ah,
so, for example, a person who's a scribe, and he sits down and he says, for the commandment of writing a Torah scroll, for the commandment of writing a pair of tefillin, which are the phylacteries, or to writing a mezuzah, it's considered to be a more novel thing to do. It's a spiritual intent here. And when you make a machine, there's a machine making it.
Right, okay,
and,
sure.
A lot of people buy the handmade matzahs, and a lot of people buy the machine-made matzahs. Mm-hmm. And there are the people who are somewhere in between where they want the handmade ones, which, by the way, are a lot more expensive. I'll give you the price range. We have three types of matzahs here in Israel. We have, I say, four types of matzahs. And you're gonna drop off your feet from this one. There's a regular matzah, the white flour matzah, which would cost you, I would say, maybe 30 shekels per kilo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a loaf of bread here in Israel, which is 750 grams, mm-hmm. costs about 5 shekels. So this is very, very expensive bread.
Sure.
But because of the process. Then you have what we call the mechona shmua, the special wheat which is kept, and it never touches any water, and they never wash it because they wash the grains. And the white flour is washed, and the whole grain is not washed.
Not washed, okay.
So this is a higher grade.
Uh-huh.
And this is also called shmua, which means from the word shamur, the root of shama, which is to keep, to protect.
Uh-huh.
And what they will do is protect, as I described it, they put in the special sacks and keep in a special place with no water.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also have a case of machine made, again, also 18 minutes. Then you have the handmade, which are always whole grain.
Mm-hmm.
And the last stage is the chabura. These are special people who come especially to make their own personal matzahs they're going to use throughout the entire Passover. And these are the most expensive. So I'm giving it to the two ends. There's 30 shekels, 35 shekels per kilo. These things sometimes reach $80 per kilo.
Wow, really? That's super keen matzah, I tell you what. So now,
yes, that is an insane matzah ever. That's the ones I was supervising.
Yeah.
So you can understand how insane it was.
That's amazing.
Because people who work on these things make a lot of money. This is extremely hard work.
Sure.
Extremely hard work. I mean, I have a friend who wanted to grind just the wheat, and they pay you per weight. You get a certain amount of money for every certain amount of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And he did this, and after 10 minutes, he said, I give up.
Oh.
It's extremely hard. It's extremely hard.
That's amazing. All this work is. I mean, I'm not kidding. It is an endurance, a high-pressure endurance sport. There should be, like, reality TV shows over this, I think. I would love to see this in action. I reckon this would just be incredible to watch.
It's extremely intense. I mean, we're not talking about literally people. It's not a marathon. People are not really running around literally and having to walk around with running shoes. But it's really, really fast. And they work really, really hard. And this is why they have breaks. And it's customarily, the guy who's paying for these special matzahs pays for the lunch. He buys them a special lunch. And he gives them bonuses.
Yeah.
He stands there and watches the people, and the people who did the best work, he gives them bonuses.
Right, and no doubt they deserve it. Clearly they deserve it.
Truly they deserve it.
My goodness.
For example, it's insane. It's not completely crazy. This is not, for example, the Grand Prix or some kind of car racing thing, but it's still, it's very difficult.
So that is handmade matzah, people. I had absolutely no idea that that is what goes on. But while I suppose the rest of the Western world is making a chocolate and pumping that out for the pagan feast of Easter, here we have in Israel handmade matzah factories. That it really does sound, I would love to see some of that action anyhow. That is incredible. So they are the three words we have. Can you just repeat them again for us, Yoel, in closing? Exodus chapter 12, verse 15, the three words that we just looked at in detail.
So we had the word se'or, which is the leavening agent. We had the word chametz, which is leavened anything, in this case leavened bread. And we have the word matzah, which is what we call the matzah, the unleavened bread, the cracker.
And there it is. And there it is. So relevant to this time of the year and so much of that that I had absolutely no idea about. And so I just want to thank you once again, my friend, for coming on and sharing that with us. Thank you for having me on your show.
This is a privilege.
It's a privilege to have you on. Once again, for the listeners, Yoel Ben Shlomo, the website, now you do have some spaces, right? If people want to learn Hebrew, you do have
I have a few spaces. Yes, I still have a few spaces.
So people are going to have emails.
Yeah, I'm getting emails every week. So the best thing to do is send me an email and I'll get in touch with you. I'll send you back an email saying yes, I have space. But it really depends. I can, for example, one day think I have no more space, and suddenly I realize a person was decided he doesn't want to go for it.
Sure, and then there's a space open up. Once again, the email is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Easy to remember, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Use that email if you're interested in getting Hebrew lessons from Yoel Ben Shlomo. And also, if you have any questions or anything to add in regards to what we've just been discussing, please leave those comments on the website themselves, truthtoyou.org. In the meantime, my friends, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of the Father's word. Shalom.